from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael. Michael Krasny, losing my voice. Let me begin this by telling you that Republican senators came to President Trump's defense yesterday over widespread reports that he used the word shithole to describe Haiti, El Salvador, and countries in Africa. Here's Senator David Perdue of Georgia, who was at the meeting where the comments were allegedly made, talking with George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week.
I'm telling you he did not use that word, George, and I'm telling you it's a gross misrepresentation. How many times do you want me to say that?
Earlier in the week, Perdue had said he didn't remember the president using such language. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois told reporters on Friday that Mr. Trump had used the word several times during negotiations on an immigration deal. And after Saturday's false missile alarm in Hawaii, Representative Tulsi Gabbard said yesterday the incident underscores the need for direct nuclear talks between the U.S. and North Korea.
I think traumatic understates the experience that the people of Hawaii went through yesterday. You know, getting that alert that went out to over a million cell phones all across the state, what to speak of the visitors who were there who got that same alert saying an incoming missile is headed your way. Take shelter. This is not a drill.
We're going to talk about all that in our weekly political roundup. And joining us is Scott Detrow, political reporter for NPR. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Also good to have James Taylor, who's right here with us in studio, professor of political science and director of African-American studies at University of San Francisco. Welcome, James.
Thank you.
And we also welcome Harmy Dillon, who is National Committee Woman for California from the Republican National Committee and former vice chair of the California Republican Party. Welcome, Harmy Dillon.
Happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. Let me begin, Scott Detrow, with you, and let's see if we can, well, sort this out just from a political standpoint. I mean, you have Dick Durbin saying this was hate-filled, vile, and racist language, that word, asshole. And then you have what we heard from David Perdue, the Georgia Republican senator, saying it's a gross misrepresentation, but he didn't use that word. And Tom Cotton of Arkansas said he didn't use that word. So it's going back and forth. How do you think this is being sorted out? Because it's just along partisan lines, or so it would seem, along partisan lines.
Well, let's walk through what we learned about this and at what point we learned about this. Multiple sources told NPR that in that initial meeting, President Trump did use that term to make a broader point that he didn't think the U.S. should let in people from Haiti, from African nations, which is what he was specifically talking about with the slur. And he said, why don't we have more people from countries like Norway? Now, we reported that. Multiple other news outlets reported that, Washington Post being first. And that evening, this is Thursday evening, the White House issued a statement and pointedly did not deny that the word was used. And Dick Durbin said that here the next day. Republican Lindsey Graham, who was in the meeting, confirmed that that word was said. And initially, Perdue and Cotton said that they just didn't recall whether or not the president used the word. They later then denied it. So I think there was very strong initial reporting that it was said. And again, I go back to the fact that the White House had an opportunity to deny this, and they chose not to do it that initial evening.
It's also, I think, important to add to the mix here that Eric Erickson, who's a fairly conservative commentator, said that a number of Trump's friends said that he was boasting about using that word, which is
we saw that a couple different places.
So what we have here is a president saying he's the least racist of presidents, and once again saying they're the least racist person you will interview. I am not a racist, all too echoing back to Nixon. I am not a crook, and all of that. But the reality is that what can be done about this? We got Congresswoman Barbara Lee in the East Bay here in the Bay Area saying we need to censure this president. We have Gavin Newsom, lieutenant governor, saying he should resign. There's a lot of Democrats who are speaking strongly. And yet at the same time, the Republicans say, well, look at Nancy Pelosi talking about five white men.
Well, I think one reason why this caused such a stir is that you can point to numerous statements that President Trump has made or been reported to have made that are pretty similar. I mean, the New York Times reported, I believe, right around Christmas that he had made similar statements in earlier meetings about immigration. And again, go back to the fact that President Trump began his presidential campaign, his very first press conference speech, saying that broad swaths of Mexicans coming into the country illegally were criminals and rapists. That was how his presidential campaign started. That set the tone for his campaign. He has made blunt statements along these lines, but you said what to do about it. The fact is President Trump had a pretty clear track record in terms of how he viewed immigration, in terms of the language that he used, in terms of his worldview. He was elected president of the United States. There is a push by House Democrats to bring up a censure resolution when it comes to this. But it's worth pointing out they also drafted a censure resolution this summer after Trump made his comments about racial violence in Charlottesville, saying there were good people on both sides of that. Only Democrats signed up for that censure resolution. It was never ultimately introduced because Republicans control the House. If no Republicans were going to sign on, it wasn't going to go anywhere.
Again, Scott Detrow with us from Washington, political reporter for NPR and former Sacramento bureau chief for KQED. Let me go to James Taylor, who's here with us in studio. He's professor of political science and directs the African American Studies program at the University of San Francisco. And we heard in the billboard earlier, John Lewis talking about how we're going back to the past, how sad he was. A lot of people are sad about this. But again, you were saying before we went on there, it's kind of become normalized almost in some strange ways. And what about the fact that this all is occurring, not so coincidentally or coincidentally, on the time that Martin Luther King's birth is being celebrated and Martin Luther King himself is being celebrated?
Yeah, I think this is a perfect storm of all kinds of American cultural and political factors coming together. Donald Trump, I've said this repeatedly, when he was elected, I've said it in many public forums here in San Francisco, that Donald Trump is the reversal of everything progressive of the past 70 years, going back to FDR. Donald Trump is sort of Ronald Reagan's last-ditch effort to undermine the New Deal and Great Society, welfare state disposition of the American government as a phenomenon. And so Trump is a reversal of all things progressive in that way, the New Deal Great Society cycle. And I think Ronald Reagan in the 80s is the beginning end of that reversal, and at least in overtly challenging it. And here we are 30 years later, Donald Trump trying to complete that process. And if you look in South African history, there's a man named Hendrik Verwoerd, who many people may know in Africa, who when the nationalists took over, surprisingly, like Trump and his party in 1948, in around two cycles, this guy Verwoerd, Hendrik Verwoerd, comes in, and he's a national hero to the Boers and to the Afrikaners in South Africa. He reverses history, and he is the one that really fortifies and solidifies apartheid. And then we have the South African struggle of the ANC and Nelson Mandela. So that's the kind of figure Donald Trump is. Donald Trump is the kind of figure like you would see sort of you think about the Plessy versus Ferguson case. You think about Reconstruction, that sort of reversal of whatever contract or progress was being made along these lines of race or national unity. There have always been reversals. And so if we look at Reconstruction, we can see the backlash to Reconstruction and Jim Crow. If you see Jack Johnson become heavyweight champion, there's a fierce backlash to Jack Johnson. I argue in my writing, in my books, that Ronald Reagan was actually the backlash to Martin Luther King. Only 12 years later, there's 12 years between Reagan's presidency and Martin Luther King's assassination. And most people don't make that connection between 68 and 1980.
And I think Van Jones calls this a blacklash.
Right. That's right. And so I think, you know, we're in these cycles. Arthur Schlesinger's very good book called The Cycles of American History talks about these 30-year cycles that we go in as a country. And I just established that, you know, we are in kind of a 30-year attempt to reverse the previous 30 years between the New Deal and the Great Society. So Donald Trump, to me, is a historically significant figure because he comes with the intention of disrupting and reversing the things that he has interpreted to be problematic, whether it's around women's position in society, immigration, Muslims specifically, African-Americans, in general. And so I think in a real way, Donald Trump has a commitment to making America the way he imagined it should be, which is a kind of 1950s worldview.
Making it great by going backward. I'm also struck by your mentioning South Africa, because the South African embassy is up in arms now about this, and there's protests going on, I think, in Johannesburg and all over the nation of South Africa as we speak, because Africa was pretty much in this umbrella indictment. And Harmeet Dhillon, let's talk with you about this from the Republican point of view. I mean, Republican defenders of the president continue to speak out, or some don't speak at all. And there's a real reckoning here in many people's minds. I mean, particularly on the day that Martin Luther King is being remembered, when you look at this whole history of pretty much what you've heard James Taylor outline, going backward.
Yeah, well, I mean, I could not disagree more with the exaggerated, hyperventilating characterization of the history of the Republican Party, Ronald Reagan, and even what this president represents than what I just heard from your prior two speakers. The fact of the matter is that under President Trump's last year in office, the African-American community has actually done very well compared to their 8 years under President Obama. And we in the Republican Party are focused on looking at people as individuals, not as recipients of a welfare state, which frankly I think is a racist thing to say by Mr. Taylor. And, you know, assuming that people are going to be an underclass and assuming that they want handouts from the government, I think that's racist. The backdrop of the comments of the president, I don't know if he said that word. I do respect the senators on each side, but I do respect Senator Cotton as well, and he said he didn't hear it. Maybe he said some variation of that word, and I've said the same day I was interviewed on Breitbart, and I said if he said that word, that was a poor choice of words, you know, insensitive. But what we're talking about here is a visa lottery program that significantly benefits and mainly benefits, to my understanding, those African nations, and it's merit. It's divorced from merit. And the trade-off here is we're talking about changing our immigration system, and I believe it should be a more merit-based system. I'm an immigrant to this country, by the way, and my parents came here on a merit-based, need-based system. This country needed doctors. My dad's a doctor. That's how I came to this country. And I do think it's absolutely legitimate for our country to focus on bringing people into this country who share American values, who contribute to this country, who are not net takers from this country, and who respect our laws and can assimilate. It's also legitimate for this country to take a look at where terrorism is originating from, to the point about Muslim immigration, and institute orders like President Obama did that restricts or significantly scrutinizes immigration from war-torn areas where there's very little government, where there is very little verification of people's identity, and where there are state sponsors of terrorism. So while it's convenient and slick for Democrats to conflate kind of cold and steely-eyed look at the benefits to America of this immigration system with racism, I think these are all issues that need to be discussed openly. And I think that one of the points that the president and the Republican senators have made is that the main people in the United States who are hurt by a tide of cheap labor and illegal immigration from south of the border are actually the African-American community, which has traditionally held a lot of those jobs that are being taken by low-skilled immigrants. And I think it's high time that we take a look at what's good for America and not necessarily what's good for the rest of the world, because that's the first priority of our government, is to take care of Americans and to make America better. I'm a proponent of more immigration that's legal and high-skilled, and we have a lot of things wrong with our system. But closing our eyes to the realities of the world and the fact that people who come here with lower educations and are unable to cope and live in self-selecting barrios or ghettos and don't integrate, that's not good for them, and that's not good for America. And sitting here in California with 3 million illegal aliens in our state and broken down roads and bad schools and crumbling infrastructure everywhere, it is a zero-sum game. The more people who come here and take from our system, the less there is left for the people who produce and contribute to the system.
Harvey Dillingen is National Committee Woman for California Republican National Committee. And let me go back, Scott Detrow, if I may, to you, because there are many who argue that this is playing quite well to President Trump's base, that, in fact, the sort of things that Harvey Dillon hit hard here will indeed perhaps come to pass through negotiations. Maybe he'll get money for the wall. Maybe he'll get extreme vetting. In other words, he's playing a hand here, as some see it, particularly the 63 million who voted for him, or many of those, that is perhaps a winning hand, getting America first again.
Well, it's hard to say what exactly President Trump is hoping to get out of these DACA negotiations. And let's take a step back. This meeting, when these comments were made, was a meeting where President Trump was being presented with a tentative deal that the six senators, three Republicans, three Democrats, had come together with. We haven't seen the full details of it, but they said that this provided permanent protections for people currently in the DACA program. These are people in the country illegally who came here as children. It provided increased border funding, which is something that President Trump said he wanted. And it also did some of the things the president has also called for in making these changes to the legal immigration system, de-emphasizing family connections and also changing the visa lottery program. These are all the things President Trump wanted. And I think it's notable that he's lashing out against this deal on Twitter over the weekend and in some of the comments he's made to reporters. Because if you go back to Tuesday, when the president presided over that remarkable meeting in the cabinet room that the press was led into for almost an hour, which is something that basically never happens, and the press was very excited about, except for the fact that all the people holding the boom mics' arms hurt by the end of that hour-long meeting, that President Trump repeatedly told the Democrats and Republicans in that meeting, I want to see a deal. I want permanent protections for DACA.
He said, I'll sign what you put forward.
Exactly. He said he would sign anything. And he said, to paraphrase, I'm not going to say, oh, I want this. Oh, I want that. I will sign it. So here he is Thursday night throwing the deal out, saying, no, I don't like it. So it's really hard to tell. And he's gone back and forth a lot. And some people say maybe this is a tactic. But it's not clear because he's literally changed his mind at some point from hour to hour, saying we can do the wall later or no, I'm going to demand a wall. Now, he's been pretty consistent the last few months saying we have to have some sort of wall here. And that's led to a lot of discussion on the Democratic side of how much are they going to fund for something that President Trump can claim as a victory for his wall.
Yeah, let me go back to Harmy Dillon on this, and then we'll hear from James Taylor. I mean, there's about 70% of American people, according to, if you believe, polling, in favor of DACA. And President Trump said, you know, he was talking love. Ann Coulter got very angry at him for using that word. She said it was too reminiscent of Jeb Bush. But now, suddenly he says it's probably dead, DACA, and then he lashes out and so forth. I mean, there's a kind of, I think you'd have to concede, unpredictability here that really is in many ways disturbing.
I don't agree with that. The magic word that hasn't been raised on this conversation so far is DAPA, the parents of these kids. So right now, as you can see from Judge Alsup's order from the Northern District of California on DACA last week, there are actually only about 700,000, a little short of 700,000 of these DACA kids, average age 24 almost. But the proposal that was presented to the president this past week included the legalization with work permits and ability to basically stay here permanently of all of the parents. And that number under the DAPA program was 4.3 million before it was struck down by the Fifth Circuit. So automatically, even though you're talking about the photogenic and sympathetic 700,000, you're actually talking about 5 million. When you add in or don't specifically limit the chain migration or family unification, which is the more traditional term for that, you're talking about millions more. And the problem for the president on that is that, and it's a very legitimate point, that Republicans have been Lucy with the football, Charlie Brown with Lucy's football many times. We've fallen for these amnesty promises that if you legalize these people one time, this is going to be it. It's not going to happen again. It's not a slippery slope. And so I think that the problem with the way the Democrats are positioning this is, frankly, they want to be the ones who give amnesty and immigration rights to millions, not just the DACA kids, but millions of other people, and get the votes and harvest the votes from them, whereas the Republicans want to solve this existing problem, but then put an end to it and say no more. We want border security. We don't want amnesty for adults who broke the law. And just because they happen to be the parents of kids who are now being given legal rights doesn't mean that we should amnesty them and skip them to the front of the line. Again, speaking as an immigrant from India, there are people from my community who've been waiting in line, filling out their legal paperwork for over a decade, adults who are being sponsored by their relatives. Why should they be put to the end of the line when people came here illegally, lived here for 15, 20 years, violated the law, and get a free pass? That's not fair. So let's not ignore that fact that there are immigrants who are waiting in line or potential immigrants who are being disadvantaged and, frankly, unfairly disadvantaged, because the reality is if we let a flood of illegal immigrants in here under amnesty, Americans are going to be, frankly, less inclined and are going to shut the door on people who've been waiting for many years.
Yeah, but
that's not fair. And we have to deal with immigration in a rational way and not prioritize illegal immigration over legal immigration. And that's what's happening here with what was presented to the president this past week.
But I'm still struck by the fact, and let me go to Professor Taylor on this, that a deal was made. A deal was essentially worked out. And then suddenly he said, no, no deal.
Yeah. As of Tuesday, it was, again, the president seemed to be working out, you know, there was a very bipartisan moment, everyone celebrating it, sort of, you know, taming a wolf's book and the fire and fury. Trump seems to be changing the conversation. And then within the 48, hour news cycle, that's completely disrupted by these comments. And so that becomes a real problem in terms of a deal being made. And the Democrats, you know, realize their position has been strengthened by Donald Trump's comments because now they're holding out and deciding that whether or not they will play with DACA and as it relates to funding the government and the government spending. But I do want to sort of correct the comment that this person just made on the other line. I didn't get up out of my bed this morning.
Harmy Dillon.
Yeah. Harmy Dillon, to come across the bridge and leave my family this morning to be called racist by her for expressing a opinion about the role of and the philosophy of conservatism as it relates to the role of government in society, going back to FDR. That is a fact. That is that has nothing to do with race. I don't know this woman to be calling me racist on radio.
Well, let me do this. Let me give out the phone number and invite our listeners to join us. We're talking about national politics news with Scott Detrow, James Taylor, and Harmy Dillon. And we do want to hear from you if you have some thoughts about the president's latest, apparent use of a word that is execrable, or according to some, maybe he didn't use the word, but you may want to weigh in here on, because there's been certainly a lot of response to it, to put it mildly, a lot of strong response on both sides. We'd like to hear your responses, and also talking about DACA, and we're going to talk about Hawaii and that false alarm that went out while the president, I might add, was playing golf. Let me give you a phone number, however, and invite you to join us now. You can do that at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Please feel free to join the program. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Number of ways you can be part of this program, and we do invite you to do that. You can also go to our Facebook page and put any comments or questions or what's on your mind there. We're discussing, again, latest political news. And I want to add, by the way, that we're going to talk about DACA later at 10:30 with California's Attorney General Javier Becerra, who will be joining us in studio. Scott Detrow with us, NPR political reporter and host of NPR Politics Podcast, James Taylor, professor of political science and director of African American Studies at University of San Francisco, and Harmy Dillon, National Committee Woman for California for the Republican National Committee. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the news and discussing really the latest political news. We're going to bring you into this conversation. I should mention that there has been a lot of response to the president's remarks. I mean, not only here in the United States, but throughout the world. The African Union has condemned his use of language. It's been translated into different ways. Haiti obviously has. Many African countries, as I said, there's protests going on in South Africa. South Sudan was probably the one country that was most, shall we say, almost neutral in its statements. They're asking for some money from the United States, but that's another story. But this is Black History Month. This is a celebration today of the birth of Martin Luther King, probably one of the major figures in United States history in the 20th century, and certainly the most major figure in the civil rights movement. And so a lot of people are quite angry and outraged. And then there are people who are defending the president and saying he never used that word and so forth. So it gets pretty complicated. But we're also talking about DACA. And I mentioned at the top, I wanted to bring in the whole question of what happened in Hawaii over the weekend with a false alarm. And it was a pretty serious false alarm that a ballistic missile was coming. And about 38 minutes went by before anything actually occurred. Scott Detrow, let's try to sort this out. The real story here, I mean, is that there were no real plans in case there was an actual missile coming from North Korea or whatever. No real exercises, nothing in place.
Well, I think the state of Hawaii, from what I understand, one reason this happened is that they have ramped up this alert system over the last few months as as tensions have risen and as the idea of an incoming missile in Hawaii would be serious enough that people would take this seriously. I mean, to me, one of the big takeaways was this does seem like it could be plausible in this current environment, given the tensions with North Korea and given the way that the rhetoric has gotten increasingly heated over the last year. So I think that's one takeaway. It looks like this was an error, a human error on the front of a state employee. They were shifting. It was a shift and somebody pressed the wrong button. And it looks like the state is going to take some measures of having two people, almost like the actual nuclear launch protocols. Two people now have to be involved in pressing the button to send out this this text alarm. But I mean, I know people vacationing in Hawaii who lived through this, and it was horrifying because you have about a half hour where you think, I'm about to die in a nuclear blast. You know, it's almost like a War of the Worlds moment of living through this experience that nobody's experienced for decades.
Well, are we in need of maybe a bigger button, President Trump would say, or something along those lines? I mean, he hit the wrong button, didn't he, basically?
Yeah. And again, I think this was a state level. This was just the emergency response system. This was not tied to any sort of military response. This was not an error, a much more frightening error of the military thinking that there was an incoming missile, which, of course, would raise a whole other host of existential questions. Hawaii's governor has profusely apologized, and it looks like they're undergoing the system top to bottom to make sure that if it happens again, it happens for real. Because I think there's a whole other question of if there was seriously an alert to go out, will people just ignore it because of this time?
Well, there was no exercise, there was no test in over 30 years, my understanding, right?
Well, I don't know. Maybe people need to practice ducking under their desks again. I think the broader question is, what can you do if there's a missile coming down on you?
We should also mention that John Kelly left the Department of Homeland Security to be in the Trump administration, and that may be a factor here as well. But let me bring in our listeners, and let me begin with a caller from Palo Alto, and that's you. Bob, you're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I had an experience when Trump became president. About a week after that, I had at least three white men. I'm a black guy with dreadlocks and a beard. And I had at least three men come up to me and go, "We're going to get you now, boy." Like they knew they have a racist president coming in.
Comment from you, Harmeet Dhillon.
I mean, in Palo Alto, really? That's interesting. I mean, I'm a person of color and a Republican, and I've seen no difference in the way people treat me since the election. I have seen rising economic opportunity for African Americans. That's a fact. And even, I think The Hill came out yesterday and said, yes, the rising economic opportunity for middle-class and lower-class Americans is due to President Trump's policies and not to the prior administration's policies. So I'm going to focus on that and the future. And again, I reiterate, I do not believe that we should categorize people according to how dependent they are on the welfare state. We should all be trying to get away from that. And so I don't see that in race terms.
What about the strong economic argument under the Trump administration, James Taylor? You know, you have people not only in terms of race saying that things are better, but across the board, stock market's booming.
Yeah, the same people who a year ago were saying, don't believe the unemployment rate, it's not true. There's a real unemployment rate, 40% unemployment amongst African-Americans. We had Pataki as governor of New York talking about 90% unemployment amongst African-Americans in New York. Again and again, it's convenient to latch on to whatever success, if you could call it that, under the Barack Obama administration. When you look at the number of people who were brought out of poverty under the Obama administration, it was 6.2 million whites, about 2 million blacks, about 1 million Latinos who were brought up out of poverty during the Obama years. Whites benefited clearly. This whole idea that that Donald Trump is presiding and he's just implemented policies that have given us the present economic condition of African Americans, it just doesn't pan out in the face of reality in terms of any specific policy that can be pointed to that has produced the unemployment effect that people are trying to take credit for. Again, we can see the economic performance of this economy going back for the past several years in terms of the job creation. It's been consistent, flatlining, straightlining across the board. And so the idea that somehow Donald Trump has implemented policies like a New Deal or you know, some specific thing that we can talk about just doesn't fly in the face of what we see.
Let me go to a couple comments here. Jan slaps my hand. She says, there's no reason for you to demonstrate your bias by stating the president was playing golf during the Hawaii false alert. That was just a fact, Jan. Thank you. Tracy writes, and I want to go to you on this, James. A lot of people are saying that that S-hole word is a kind of dog whistle for bigots, and the first caller seems to indicate that. But here's Tracy writes, the expletive is not explicitly racist, but horribly demeaning. And why would Norwegians want to come here? Which is something that a lot of people have been joking about.
Because
things are so advanced. But what about that argument? I mean, if you want to accuse the president of racism, some would say go back to Charlottesville and, you know, go back to other things. But this is really just... A lot of people probably feel that way about.
Yeah, but I think it's the Central Park jogger. It's all of this that you know, Donald Trump's comments about Latinos, about Mexican immigrants, about different groups in the society that makes this seem like the S-hole is racist, even if it's, you know, empirically objective as a term. People are reading race into it, not because it is inherently racist in and of itself, but because of Donald Trump's reputation around this. So he has sort of made this bed himself. And for the president to have to say every day, I'm the least racist president, I'm the least racist person you know, who really says that? How many people do you know in your private life that go around saying I'm the least racist person you know? As a genuflection, as a default way of communicating their views of race. I don't go around saying I'm not a black racist. I'm not a racist. I'm not a racist. I'm not a racist. And if I am, there's something wrong with me.
Well, let me bring another caller on here. Let me go before I go to you, Harmeet. Let me go to John because he has a comment directed to you. John, go ahead.
Thank you. So my comment is directed to your Republican guest, and I find her comments very objectionable. First of all, her comment about self-selecting barrios ignores the fact that for many decades, America deliberately pursued a policy of redlining to force communities of color into ghettos, basically. She ignores the fact that, for instance, mass incarceration has done terrible damage to the black community. You know, we saw the crack epidemic where the solution was it's a black drug, so let's put them all in prison. With opioids, it's a white drug, so let's get them all in treatment. And the simple fact is that she's ignoring and trying to hide, in fact, is that if you give a person of color and a white person equal opportunity, they are not going to have equal outcomes because we white people have put the people of color at such huge disadvantages that they simply cannot perform equally given an equal opportunity. So there is a need for, you know, extra assistance to get out of the hole that we white people dug for them.
All right, John, I thank you for the call. I want to go to Harmeet Dhillon. She had a response to what Professor Taylor said, and I'd like to hear a response to you as well.
Well, I just said about what Professor Taylor actually denied being a racist earlier on this call when he is very happy to paint all Republicans as racist dating back to Ronald Reagan and before and generations of them.
What is she talking about? What show is this woman listening to?
Let her finish, please.
I grew up in the Deep South, where I had signs on the highway that said the Ku Klux Klan welcome you to Smithfield, North Carolina. You know who put those signs up? Democrats. That's why my parents registered as Republicans back then in the Deep South.
So a Democrat today is not a Democrat.
Hold on, let me finish. I'm sorry.
About that. So, you know, you should not make assumptions about people based on their skin color. That's all I'm saying.
Right. And let me just let me just say again, I don't know who this person is on the other line, but again, when you look at the history of partisanship, there is no more powerful explanatory variable in American history, not gender, not economics, not class, not region, not education. Nothing explains partisanship more powerfully in American political science than race. The book you can look at is called Issue Evolutions by Carmines and Stimson, published 1989. There is no other more powerful explanation. So for you to suggest that to talk about race and partisanship and party ideology, conservatism, liberalism, et cetera, with a political scientist, you know, and to then characterize it as racist when I talk about the 30-year ideological shifts and cycles grounded in American political history with Arthur Schlesinger, it seems to me that you have an issue with partisanship because I don't belong to a party. I don't belong to the Democrats. I don't belong to a Republican. I believe both parties are problematic.
All right, let me leave it there.
So you're defending
Taylor.
A party. I'm not defending a party.
I want to bring on more callers. It shows perhaps how easy it is to bandy the word racist around now in light of the president's remark. But let me give Guillermo a chance. chance here. Guillermo, go ahead, because he's from El Salvador. I want to hear from you. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my phone call. You know, one thing that I noticed is that the president has not been making any comments to the other crowd of immigrants who are big and huge communities, the Chinese community, the Indian community, which my understanding, India is also a very poor country. And my question is whether the president has been taking a specific countries and specific groups just to say these groups but not these groups, because that's what my interest is, that's where my hotels are, that's what my business are, that's what I do most of my business, my golf course. So if that is a conflict of interest by saying, wait a minute, I'm just going to trash these communities, but I'm going to excuse these other communities because I have business with these nations.
And you think about that, Scott Detrow, in terms of your response? Selective on the part of the president?
Just in terms of what he focused on? I mean, I think President Trump has clearly focused on very narrow areas, especially when it comes to his Twitter feed, which I often think is of kind of the soul of his outward-facing presidency, in that that is where he puts a lot of his attention. That is where multiple reports say President Trump spends a lot of time each day thinking through what to put out on Twitter. It's the prime way of communicating with the country and the world and with other political leaders, and he often does narrowly pick areas like the NFL controversy, for example, repeatedly coming back to it over and over again, because I think it's something that he thinks animates his base voters, the people who came on early to the Trump candidacy and have been energized by his presidency.
Let me read a comment from John, who says, I am tired of everyone just talking outrage. Where is the action? Haiti and the African countries should be expelling U.S. diplomats. Haiti should be inviting Russia or China to build a naval base. That would get Congress's attention quick and maybe provoke some civility in our leadership. By the way, you can add your comments here or any questions you might have by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, and you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Since we're doing a news roundup, let me just ask you, Scott Detrow, about something else that came out in the news over the weekend in a big way, and that was an alleged payment to a porn star by the name of, actually her name is Stephanie Clifford, but she uses the name Stormy Daniels. And this, what's interesting about this story, which has been denied by the White House, is number one, Steve Bannon in, his comments in Michael Wolff's book said that there may have been as many as 100 women paid off by President Trump before the election. I'm just putting that out there, taking a side here. But there's been denial, and yet the story appeared in the Wall Street Journal, which is pretty significant, I think, because the Wall Street Journal has been, you know, very supportive, certainly, of President Trump and the Republican Party.
Yeah, that was a Wall Street Journal report. I haven't seen those facts elsewhere at the moment, and that's something that NPR has not confirmed at this point. So I think you laid out the details, again, that came from the Wall Street Journal.
Well, let me ask you another question, though, because there's a kind of normalization factor here. I mean, this is not meant in any partisan way, but you remember the Monica Lewinsky scandal and, you know, just how much waves there were as a result of that. And there's been a lot of comment on this, certainly from Democrats, that stories play very differently in terms of political parties.
In terms of the response to that specific story? Well, I mean, I think let's talk about
in other words,
cycle.
If this had been during the Obama administration, for example, or you know, a Democratic administration, it would have been, so the argument goes, a very different and much more vehement response.
Well, you also had cable news and the bulk of public radio and every other news outlet focusing on the what President Trump said or didn't say in the Oval Office meeting, the state of the DACA negotiations. I mean, one of the things that's happened over the last 2 years is that at any given moment, there's probably six or seven stories that would have dominated the headlines for weeks at a time at any other point in any other administration.
And Scott Detrow is NPR political reporter, host of the NPR Politics podcast. And our next caller is Robert. Robert, join us.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hate to do this, but I've got to start with this, sadly, in this environment. I'm white. I was a former Republican back in my teens, 18 years old. I worked for Ronald Reagan's run for the presidency. I'm now a Democrat, former U.S. Air Force. And the reason I state that is because everything has become so partisan in this country that and it's really around policy. And that's, you know, I'll come back to what I think Trump is up to. But the Republican Party, by and large, is has moved from the Democrats in the South. It switched over to the Republican Party back in the 60s with activities by George Wallace and others, are working on policies that are really to protect white power in the United States. It used to be called in South Africa apartheid. When you look at the efforts that are done with restricting voting, when you combine that with the efforts of gerrymandering, when you combine that with the efforts to limit immigration and to push who should be citizens, the DACA kids, to citizenship, the policies, you know, setting aside the lies, and that's hard to do, setting aside the racist commentary, which is really hard to do. The real thing that I'm concerned about in the United States is that there's a real push to recognize that the demographic trends are working against white people, working against people of privilege, and an effort to change our democracy into one that can protect that power. And the only time to do that is when you have power. And when you have the state legislatures, when you have the ability to implement policies, and you can placate people, you can have the stock market go up by adding $1.5 trillion and spending future money to dole that money out to the people that own stocks. But in the end,
Robert, this is a thoughtful call, but I think you're going on a little too long. There are many people who are waiting to talk here. Let me cut to the chase here. Let me go to Harmy Dillon on this, because I think he's a former Republican who's expressing some dissatisfaction and saying that things have been allied really against people of color from the Republican Party. And I know you vociferously go against that. So let's hear from you on that, Harmy Dillon.
Well, all I can say is we have a fundamentally different perspective in the party. And, you know, we can see the stark differences in our government in Sacramento, which is dominated exclusively by Democrats. And it's all about handouts and pork and, you know, racial gerrymandering and looking at everybody as members of a tribe as opposed to individuals, which is really the dream that I see from the Constitution. Republicans want to look at people as individuals. You don't get anything special because you're black, white, or whatever. You should rise or fall on your merit. That's the principle that I espouse and what I believe in and what I think the president believes in fundamentally. If I thought he were a racist, I've met him many times, I would not be supporting him or been a delegate for him or done a prayer at the national convention like I did. And I wouldn't have been invited to do a prayer in Punjabi as a Sikh covering my head if this were a racist party. So that's my own personal experience and what I see myself. And as an immigrant, I can tell you the question was raised by your previous caller about, you know, why the president is focusing on some countries rather than others. Well, when you look at the cold facts of immigrant communities in this country, some immigrant communities, like Chinese, like Indian American, like, by the way, Nigerian, have higher incomes on average and higher educational accomplishment on average in their minority communities here than white Americans.
You mentioned Nigeria, though. Don't you think it's, I mean, when the president talked about Nigeria at one point, he said all the people there live in huts. And when he talked about Haiti, he talked about most Haitians having AIDS.
But you're interrupting what I'm going to say, which
Sorry.
Is that it's the elites in those countries who have come to this country, okay? And I mean, I will be the first person to tell you that I would never go back to live in India if you gave me $1 billion, because I don't want to live in a place where people defecate in the streets. So that is a problem in the third world. And in some of these countries, the elites have come here historically. Nigeria is one of those countries, and some of the other African countries. From other countries with the more preponderance of the lottery-based situation, it's really the people who are the most desperate, and certainly people from south of the border who come here on foot or in other ways and not flying here with a university degree. There are different patterns of immigration in this country. And like I said before, I do think it's important for us to not judge people. And I said, if the president is saying people from certain countries shouldn't come here, I don't think he said that. I think what is legitimate is to say everybody who comes here should be subjected to some of the same rigorous analysis. Maybe there needs to be means testing. There is means testing when you sponsor relatives, for example. So maybe there needs to be some across the board looking at people as individuals.
Or extreme vetting, as the president is saying, right?
That's whatever you want to call it. Is it good for America to bring this person in? That should be the analysis. And every country has that. I can't go hang out in India anymore. Mexico doesn't allow immigrants from Guatemala to hang out there. And so I think it is absolutely legitimate for the country to protect its borders and have objective criteria as to what's good for America. That's not racist. That's just, you know, the responsibility of a government. Our resources are not endless.
All right. I thank you for that, Harmeet Dhillon. Let me go back to Professor Taylor. James Taylor, the argument here might be that there are many Republican parties and Republicans of different stripes. I mean, the argument that one hears is that President Trump indeed is playing to his base here, and his base loves this.
Yeah, Barry Goldwater today would not be able to relate to this party. And he actually said in the conscience of a conservative, ultimately one day he would be considered a liberal. I think Ronald Reagan, too, would be to the left of what's happening now. You can look at Richard Hofstadter's work in terms of the paranoid style in American politics. It talked about this phenomenon where you would end up with this hard right element in American politics that would not be beholden to its constitution or to any sort of party orientation in traditional politics, but that it would be hostile to government. It's not against, it's not simply critical of government, it's anti-government. And that is the element I think that Hofstadter tried to identify with. And this is, I think, part of the real issue when you talk about this continuum of Republican. Donald Trump and someone like Rockefeller are very different people, very wealthy men, but ideologically, in terms of social and cultural questions and cultural issues, they're very different. And Donald Trump, it seems to me, has taken this party in a very rightward direction, in the same way that Bill Clinton took the Democrats in a right direction, to the right of center with his Democratic Leadership Council. So I think our party system is reflecting our political polarization, the red state, blue state phenomena that Tim Russert identified a long time ago. And that is our politics. Is a polarization, and even issues like taxes and health care, they may seem to be racially neutral conversations. They have nothing to do with race, right? But budgets reflect priorities around culture and society. Who gets what, when, and how is how most political scientists define politics. We define political science or politics by who gets what, when, and how, in tribute to Howard Laswell. So I think it's really important to sort of flesh out that there was a time just in my lifetime when the Republican Party was the party that was preferred by most blacks. My dissertation at USC was called Black Politics in Transition, From Protest to Politics to Political Neutrality with a question mark, asking, can blacks find a third way? Both parties, as much as Ms. Dhillon is, you know, fighting hard for her party, I reject both parties.
Well, let me go to Scott Detrow on this, and maybe he can give some.
I'm happy to circle it back to
let's get a repertorial point of view here.
Yeah, right? Which is how this all started. What happens next with DACA? Because there's pressure on both sides to get this done within the next week or so. I think it's going to be hard to get a deal, even if you take President Trump out of the equation, because a lot of the things that Harmeet was talking about are what a lot of Republicans, particularly in the House, want to see. They want broad changes to the immigration system. And Democrats, on the flip side, are very resentful of the fact that anything has to come along with DACA, that they have to trade the fate of DACA protectees, about 700,000 people, for policies they don't want. So the deal we were talking about between six senators is going to be a very hard sell on both sides of the aisle. And I think even if President Trump had fully endorsed it last week, it'd be tough to see how it gets the votes it needs in the House. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty about what happens next and a tight timetable, because one last element that's interesting is that by and large, negotiators in Congress are ignoring this federal court ruling that has extended DACA, saying we need to act as if this is ending in March because we want to get this done in time in case it does.
Let me bring another caller on, and that's Laura, who is a Democrat but agrees with vetting immigrants. Go ahead, Laura.
Yes, just a quick comment. I've been a Democrat all my life, but I've just observed, you know, I live in the Bay Area, and so, you know, we have a very rich population of many types of immigrants. But it's been my observation, particularly after working in public schools for almost 20 years, that I think that we do need to have, you know, some higher vetting processes in place to kind of ensure that, you know, people do have the capability of moving towards, you know, what the American dream is, which is to be employable, speak our language, you know, be taxpayers, et cetera, et cetera. And I see that becoming somewhat, well, it has not becoming, it has become a problem in many cases. We have schools that are obligated to have multiple languages, and, you know, we can't hold meetings without interpreters. And part of that is fine, but you should be able to see some growth and some improvement over a course of years within families. You know, I mean, it's just a very simple way of looking at it. And I think there obviously is more to it. But I do feel that, you know, there are some problems there that need to be addressed honestly by both parties, not just the Republicans. But I think the Democrats also need to kind of take a look at this.
All right, Laura, let me thank you for your call. Appreciate hearing from you, and read a couple quick comments here. Mike writes, during all the outrage at Trump's disparaging remarks about countries with people of color and immigrants, few comment that such behavior only solidifies his popularity with a dwindling base of white fans. And Sue says, thank you for finally focusing on what actually went on in the meeting where Trump allegedly said the vulgar word. Too much is focused on one word and not on how this president doesn't seem to know what he's doing. We'll let it stand there, and we'll thank our guests. Thanks to Scott Detrow, political reporter for NPR. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks. Always exciting.
And thanks, James Taylor, professor of political science and director of the African American Studies Program at University of San Francisco.
Thank you.
And thanks to Harmeet Dhillon, National Committee Woman for California, Republican National Committee, and former vice chair of the California Republican Party.
Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Coming up ahead, Amy Tan and the Attorney General, Javier Becerra. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.